I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation today, it's about meat. Americans eat twice the global average, and people around the world eat three times as much as they did a few decades ago. So what is that doing to the world? But first, there's been little reaction in Miami to news that 81-year-old Fidel Castro is resigning after five decades as president of Cuba. Cuban exiles say they don't expect much change. And for reaction from Havana, we turn to Ray Sanchez. He's Havana correspondent for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Ray, what's the reaction there?
It seemed like business as usual. People hitchhiking rides to work, school children lined up outside schools, singing the national anthem in the early morning, and just people, people hustling to get to work and get around in a city where transportation is scarce and I think Cubans have pretty much resigned themselves to the fact that Fidel Castro is no longer the player that he was in the political scene here.
It's so funny that there is this muted reaction because there's been 50 years of this wish on the part of his opponents that he would leave, and now that he's stepped down, it just is, it's kind of odd in a funny way that it is so muted.
It is strange. I think that the biggest difference here is that Cubans have been dealing with this for about 19 months now, and aside from Raul raising expectations, they've seen very little changes, very little real changes in their lives. And
do they expect any now that it's been made official?
I think, yeah, that's going to be, I think they do, and I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for the new leadership, for Raul Castro and the new leadership, will be to deliver on promises that he's made. I mean, he's invited the public to discuss the problems of the country and the needs of the people, and I think now that it's official and he's formally in power, I think he will certainly feel the pressure to deliver.
Ray Sanchez, Havana correspondent for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, speaking to us from Havana. Ray, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And as Ray said, Castro's brother Raul has been acting president and is expected to take over. In his nearly five decades in power, Fidel Castro survived assassination attempts, a failed invasion, and a U.S. trade embargo, which U.S. officials said today will continue. So what is next? Gary Marks is former Havana correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He's a visiting fellow at the Kellogg Institute for International Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Gary, are you surprised at how muted the reaction has been?
Actually, I'm not very surprised at all. I mean, this move by Fidel was not a surprise to most people. And, I think Cubans in many ways have really moved on. You know, he has not been seen in public or given any sort of public appearance in the last 18 months since he announced he had undergone emergency surgery. So, many Cubans had already begun looking beyond Fidel to his brother Raul and any possible changes.
And what do you see, and those of you who read those tea leaves, what do you see about possible changes?
Well, I think Raul has sort of indicated that he's interested in reforms, limited probably market reforms that will improve the daily the life of average Cubans, which remains incredibly difficult. I mean, there's a lot of discontent on the island, and it's focused primarily around the fact that average salaries are $19 or $20 a month, and they just don't go very far, and people have problems putting food on the table and things like that. So, I mean, that's where the reforms will probably come. They will be slow. They will be very measured. Anybody who's expecting, democracy or Chinese-style capitalism are going to be sorely disappointed.
Well, but how much have people been able to speak out about, requests for reform? The BBC had a tape of meetings between Raul Castro and some students who were complaining about, as you said, the low wages, but also asking why can't we travel abroad or have access to the Internet? Has there been more pressure, or, is there still a clampdown on that kind of expression?
Well, Raul Castro has sanctioned, and the key word is sanctioned, Cubans at meetings, at work sites that are organized by the government to list their complaints. So that is something that is rare, and that is something that has been good. I think Cubans have really gotten a lot of their concerns off their chest. It's not as if this is new to Raul Castro. It's not as if he has not heard these complaints before. But the idea is that Cubans could actually express themselves, I think, is good and is a sign of hope to Cubans. But you got to understand, this is all within the revolution. Nobody is standing up and saying in public that they want, you know, they want a multi-party democracy. Nobody is saying that they want to scrap the current system. So I think, you know, this sort of organized criticism is got to be put in its proper context. And Raul is a committed socialist. Yes, he will institute some pragmatic reforms, but only to strengthen the socialist system.
Well, and Raul also was said to have released some political prisoners, but not enough to satisfy U.S. officials. President Bush and presidential candidate John McCain saying today that there'd have to be real human rights reform before there was any relaxing of the embargo. Is that, you know, kind of pretty much the line?
That, you know, that is the position of all the major candidates on both sides. Although I have to say Barack Obama has taken, you know, he stepped out of the fold a little bit. He has said that if he were to become president, he would lift travel restrictions on Cuban Americans visiting their relatives on the island, and he would also lift the limitations on the remittances, the amount of money Cuban Americans can send to their family members. So Barack has taken a leadership position on this issue. All the other candidates have sort of stepped in line saying, you know, Cuba has to make the first move before there'll be any modification of the embargo.
Well, we should point out, you say he's taken a leadership position. Many Cuban exiles, Castro opponents would say that's dangerous talk, you know, to have any movement before this human rights reform.
Right. And then, I mean, you know, I can only voice sort of my opinion on this, living 5 years in Cuba. I just don't think the embargo has worked. You know, if the goal of the embargo was to topple the government or weaken the government, I mean, it's been in place for 50 years, and the Cuban the revolution remains there. I think there really needs – it's really time for a change and a shift in policy. And I think that, you know, opening up trade and travel to the island, I'm not saying it would be a panacea. Again, I'm not saying the Cuban government would respond by automatically opening up their political or economic system. But it's clear to me the current policy hasn't worked.
Gary Marks, former Havana correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, and we should say not a spokesperson for that government in any means. His credentials were pulled when the government felt that his reporting on the island was too negative. He's now a visiting fellow at the Kellogg Institute for International Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Gary, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
At least seven school districts in Michigan are busy today throwing out meat. Grand Rapids is getting rid of 10 tons of hamburger. Public schools in Ann Arbor are reportedly tossing 300 pounds of beef. And Detroit public schools have 150 cases of frozen chili and taco meat to dispose of. After yesterday's meat recall, the largest ever in the country's history, the federal government pulled 143 million pounds of beef out of circulation, prompted by a secret video that showed workers at the slaughterhouse of the Westland Hallmark Meat Company in Chino, California, abusing cattle too sick to walk, poking them with electric prods, shoving them with a forklift, in violation of laws requiring that animals be able to walk to slaughter. Today, government health officials say the risk of illness from that meat is very low. They say most of the meat involved has already been consumed. Cattle industry leaders are saying the incident was isolated. But the Humane Society said they randomly targeted the slaughterhouse for an investigation, and the chair of the House Agriculture, Food and Drug Administration subcommittee says she is concerned that the video demonstrates how far our food safety system has collapsed. Well, our guest today says there's a bigger problem. Gidon Eshel is a geophysicist at the Bard Institute in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Professor Eshel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And give us your headline about meat production and the way we eat meat.
Well, we eat too much of it, don't we? It exerts pretty substantial environmental costs that are probably disproportionate to what we actually get out of it.
Well, let's talk about some of the numbers. You say too much. Mark Goodman, food writer for the New York Times, recently wrote an article and quoted liberally some of these numbers. They are astonishing numbers. How much meat do we eat?
About 230 or 40 pounds per person per year, or about 0.6 pound per person per day.
And this is since 1961, a huge increase. In 1961, 71 million tons. In 2007, 284 million tons worldwide. America, 5% of the world's population, slaughters nearly 10 billion animals a year, more than 15% of the world's total. A huge increase in eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so some would say, what's wrong with that? You know, eating more meat means a better standard of living has been achieved.
Actually, it's the exact opposite. It's only true what you said, and of course, you've been quoting something that's been said a lot. It's only true if you think that that part of high standard of living is exercising your right to get sick and sicker. Only then would that make sense to say that the more we eat food that clearly undermines our health, the better off we are.
Well, and then the other concerns seem to be how sick it may be making the earth. Tick off the concerns about the resources it takes to produce meat.
Well, I mean, it consumes tremendous amounts of land and water, and most of the pollution, literally most of the pollution in this country that's not toxic arises from agriculture, and a very large portion of that arises from animal raising operations.
Animal waste polluting water supplies, antibiotics being used on animals that then go further into the supply, a significant increase of greenhouse gases requiring more amounts of corn, soy, and other grains to feed the animals. And make that connection between more grains going to feed livestock to produce steaks as opposed to being eaten by people around the world.
Well, here's a really amazing number. Three states of the Union in the Midwest, three states alone produce enough calories in soy and corn together to feed every single American for a day, every single American a day, almost 11,000 kilocalories. Now, most people need about, you know, between, let's say, 2,000 and 2,500. Okay, so we produce about four to five times as much as we actually need, only in those three states, only in soy and corn. That's just staggering. You know, let's hypothetically assume that we would only eat plants. Well, in that case, we could do away with all of the agriculture except for those three states.
Well, and that's for geophysicist Gidon Eshel. We have about a minute till a break. Question, are you saying we should only eat plants because of the problems, because of the starvation of other people around the world not getting grain because of the heart disease caused by eating so much meat? Are you saying everyone should just eat plants?
No, definitely not. I mean, I think every person should eat whatever he or she favors. It's one of those things like driving, you know. Nobody, I don't think, suggests that we just drop driving altogether. But we can drive less.
And save in ways that we could save if we use less oil. Gidon Eshel, we're going to come back in 1 minute and ask, well, how do we do that? Ask about things like meat without feet, meat being created in petri dishes. Is that a solution? Or is it just people cutting back on how much they eat meat? And how do we do that if we've become addicted to it? Back with more from Professor Gidon Eshel in 1 minute, here and now. We've been speaking about the link between eating meat and more, not just Americans, but people around the world eating meat, and the effect that has on the environment. We're speaking with Professor Gidon Eshel, a geophysicist at the Bard Institute in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And Professor, you were just saying that, okay, maybe everyone couldn't become a vegetarian, but, you know, eat less meat, much in the way we're asked to perhaps drive less. Or you've given an example of what could happen if we reduced meat consumption and how that compares to maybe switching from a standard sedan, a Camry car, to a Prius. So you do make this comparison to changes we're being asked to make in driving. What's that comparison?
Well, the difference between the mean American diet and a purely plant-based diet is about a ton and a half of CO2 equivalent per person per year, out of about 20, which is the total, and about 4 to 5 that is due to diet. So a difference of a ton and a half per person per year is not very different from the difference that switching from a Camry to a Prius will result in. They're very similar.
And this would reduce a lot of the issues we've been talking about, deforestation caused by raising grain to feed beef as opposed to having forest, pollution from the runoff from these factories, heart disease from eating too much meat, animal cruelty, as we've seen in the recent tape that was just released. But what about some of the solutions that have been proposed or are being explored? For instance, we hear about meat without feet, you know, meat being created in the petri dish that doesn't involve live animals.
I think it's interesting from the standpoint of basic fundamental life science, but from the standpoint of eating, I think you will be hard pressed to even dream that this has any bearing on what people eat. Mm-hmm. People don't eat experimental tissues. People eat food.
Well, but people are already eating, we discovered on this program, cloned meat. We spoke to a rancher who actually was raising cloned meat, and before the FDA said it was allowable, was putting it in the food supply, and he got very angry at Americans who might respond negatively to that. He said, you know, you pressure us to produce this meat to meet your demand, and yet you don't want to know how meat is made.
Well, I will not include myself in that, and he has every right to be angry all he wants, but we never asked him to produce that meat. This meat is produced and consumed with to the extent that it does because the government hands out dole that he's on.
Well, just explain that a little bit because, you know, the meat industry, as you've explained, is subsidized much the way the oil industry is.
Actually, I think that direct subsidies are part of the problem, but a pretty small one, and haven't been at all a part of it recently because ethanol drove prices above the threshold below which farmers get government subsidies. So direct subsidies to crops are part of the problem, but not a huge part. The main issue is that the pollution caused by farming practices is essentially free. And, you know, every American, I think, knows the story or the tragedy of the commons, you know. And that's what farms do. They degrade and compromise the ecological integrity of the commons.
To tell us the story of the tragedy of the commons, is this, you know, runoff of waste? Is that what you're saying? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's one of the ways. Runoff of nutrient-heavy water from over-fertilizing, runoff of toxic water related to incomplete decomposition of herbicides and pesticides.
Well, do you differentiate them between meat that's from free-range animals who graze on grass and meat perhaps bagged by hunters who eat what they consume and these assembly line meat factories?
Oh, yeah, of course.
But
I mean, hunters do nothing wrong, in my view.
But
except, I mean, they kill animals, and if you care about animals, then they do something wrong. But that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
We're talking about the environment.
Right. And, in fact, you know, the rights of animals is very important to you. But in speaking about the environment, then you get to the sticky question of, do you then only have wealthy people who can afford to go to stores where they can buy meat that has been promised to have been grazed on grass and animals that have been treated gently through slaughter? Then only wealthy people eat meat.
I don't buy this argument at all. Again, it's a very commonly voiced argument, but I think it's entirely false. Poor people, let's say in Mexico or in large parts of the third world, having a hard time eating, you know, basic corn and other grain-based food because of Archer Daniels Midland, and that has nothing whatever to do with meat or subsidies. So I don't find that argument at all compelling.
Gidon, people are, you know, becoming more aware of how animals are treated. They're making demands of people who produce their food. In about the 2 minutes we have left, what do you think has to happen? Is it more regulation? These companies, these slaughterhouses that we saw yesterday were supposed to be regulated. Or is it people, you know, people cutting back and reducing the demand? What's the solution?
The solution is to apply much more vigorously and aggressively the Clean Water and Clean Air Act and apply them to agricultural practices. As soon as these guys have to pay for the damage that they cause, well, in that, as soon as that happens, meat and beef and so on will not be so cheap as they are today anymore, and then people will have less of them. It's very, very simple. We don't need any more regulations additional laws in the books. We have them. They are the Clean Water and Clean Air Act. We just need to give them renewed teeth and apply them with a little renewed vigor.
Gidon Eshel, geophysicist at the Bard Institute in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and I should say a cattle rancher in Israel before these issues and the issue of animal cruelty began to have him thinking in this direction. Professor Eshel, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Still to come today, Nobel laureate Dr. David Baltimore on the quest for an AIDS vaccine. Will we ever see one? And if there's doubt, should we still keep trying? Also later today, singer-songwriter Laurie McKenna. You don't want to miss her music. That's still to come after the news here and now. Dr. David Baltimore is one of the leading scientific voices of his generation. He won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for his work on the genetics of viruses in 1975. He was the founder of the Whitehead Institute at MIT. His resume also includes his resignation as president of Rockefeller University in 1991 amid the controversy over whether a former colleague had fabricated research data. Dr. Baltimore stood by her and her work. So he's been on the science front lines and in the foxhole. And today, Dr. Baltimore directs a lab at the California Institute of Technology that received a $14 million grant from the Gates Foundation to work on improving immunity to the AIDS virus. Dr. Baltimore is also president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which met in Boston recently, and that gave us a great opportunity to talk about the state of science. I brought him into the studio and asked him first to describe what he's doing with that Gates Foundation money.
What we're trying to do is to take a different attack on the problem of making an AIDS vaccine, initially trying to make the immune system be useful in fighting AIDS. The immune system is not useful ordinarily because the virus has found all sorts of quite impressive ways around the immune system. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to be as smart as the virus is and see if we can't attack it from a different point of view.
You understand one of the ways is to remove cells and then genetically alter them and then put them back in the hopes that they have a new sort of attitude.
That's right. We want to actually remove bone marrow stem cells, which are the cells that give rise to the immune system, modify those genetically so they'll do things they ordinarily wouldn't do, and put them back with the hope that this is a way of providing immunity against HIV.
You know, we wanted to ask you about where you think the state of certain diseases and issues are. Staying there with HIV, you call your research chancy. So what do you think the chances are of having an HIV vaccination in our lifetime?
People who look at the situation today often come to the conclusion that there will be no HIV vaccine. And you could come to that conclusion. I think the data that exists today are every good reason for pessimism. But I don't think the scientific community can allow itself to become pessimistic because it's just too important. It's hard to believe that with all of the engineering capabilities that the scientific community has developed in biology in particular, that we can't find some way around the defenses of HIV.
Well, you wrote an editorial in the journal Science this month in which you noted tensions between science and national security since 9/11, foreign scientists, for instance, not getting visas.
We run the risk of losing our openness to the world scientific community. Young people, for instance, in training, coming from all around the world. You look at the American Nobel Prizes in science, many go to people who were born abroad. So openness is in our interests, and yet national security suggests we should be looking very carefully at who's coming in. And we have to reach a balance which is in our interests. And our interest is largely, from my point of view, on the side of openness.
Well, and this brings us to tensions between politics and science, debates that we've been listening to over the last few years over stem cell research, evolution, whistleblowers like the FDA's David Graham, who claimed his department was serving the drug industry and not the public. How difficult is it to have conversations about science without them being politicized?
it's true that the scientific community is less able than it used to be to stand aside from the big issues of politics. And I think that's one reason why in this campaign we're seeing an activism on the part of the scientific community that we've never seen before. We, the scientific community, 16,000 strong, are asking for a science debate between the standing candidates in April, answering questions about stem cells, about openness to science, about the ability of government scientists to speak out when they have something to say.
Well, there's a good chance that if that debate takes place at April 18th at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia,
yes,
you may have several candidates if John McCain continues his march, and if Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are still neck and neck. You may have at least three candidates who, for instance, agree in stem cell research. John McCain very much angering
right,
the right in the Republican Party because he does believe in that. Do you think that changing presidents might automatically leapfrog findings in stem cell research? It does not work that way.
There would be a very rapid change, I think, because funding would be made available through the federal government to fund stem cell research in the United States, which today can't be done.
And what do you think is possible? Let's remind our listeners. The objection to embryonic stem cells has been that there are those who feel that they come from embryos that are life. But embryonic stem cells were the only ones that had a sort of blank slate property. They could become any cell, and from there you could grow any organ or tissue. Look into the near future. What do you think's next?
What we found recently is that if you take skin cells or other kinds of cells of the body and you put a few new genes in them, that you can induce them to revert to a stem cell-like state. That may, in fact, solve the problem of the derivation of stem cells from embryos, but it may not. We need to compare the two very carefully. We need to understand the consequences of these gene insertions. The opportunity to do all of this with federal funding would allow bright young investigators who today may have shied away from working in this field to go in and help make it a reality.
I guess to what end?
One end is scientific. We can investigate what goes wrong when embryos have mutations that lead to disabilities of one form or another. But there's a therapeutic side in that stem cells are cells. They're like every cell in our body. And if we can make them change into cells that are therapeutically useful, like liver cells for a person whose liver has failed, then they can have a very important therapeutic value in modern medicine.
We touched on the fact that you were a part of a group of scientists hoping that the presidential candidates will come to an event in Philadelphia in April. What do you think they should be asked?
Do you support alternative energy investigations, and of what sort? Will you support increased funding for biomedical research? Biomedical research has taken a 13% real cut since 2004. I don't think we should talk only about funding, though. We should talk about the teaching of science to young people. Are we going to do anything to make our country more scientifically literate?
But how do you square the questions that need to be asked, the work that you say needs to be done, with the fact that a huge percentage of Americans don't believe in evolution? What does a scientist do about that?
You shake your head in disbelief, for one thing. But it's certainly a large fraction of the population that believes this. And this is quite particular to the United States. It's not true abroad that anything like that fraction of people disbelieve evolution. I think it's a crying shame because these are people who cannot participate in modern biological scientific thinking at all, since it's all based in evolution. Seeing organisms as all related to one another and understanding that what we learn in one organism is relevant to another organism because they are brothers in their DNA, if you wish. So I wish that we would be much clearer in our teaching of science in elementary and high school science, that evolution is a fact. It's not a theory. It's not something to be debated about whether it occurred or not. You can debate about how it occurred. You can debate about the rate it occurred. You can debate about a lot of things, but not if it occurred.
Dr. David Baltimore, President of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for coming to the studio to speak to us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, a profile of Barack Obama and a visit with author Russell Banks. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Just when you thought there wasn't anything left to learn about Abraham Lincoln, did you know he read Shakespeare out loud on the steps of his summer cottage, where he also encountered Union soldiers who walked right into his room and asked him for favors? And during his commute back to the Capitol, he regularly passed and nodded to poet Walt Whitman. A new museum opening in Washington today gives us a glimpse into some of this hidden history. The museum is in the cottage at the Soldiers' Home on a hilltop just 3 miles north of the Capitol. President Lincoln and his wife Mary first sought refuge there after the death of their 11-year-old son Willie in 1862. They also spent summers at the cottage because it was much cooler there than in swampy Washington. Matthew Pinsker, professor of history at Dickinson College, is the author of Lincoln's Sanctuary, and he helped design the new museum. Matt, you write, it is impossible to trace the course of Lincoln's presidency without taking into account the experience he had at the Soldiers' Home. Why?
You can't understand Lincoln the leader until you understand Lincoln the person. And the best way to see those two forces merge is where he lived when he made up his mind about some of the great decisions of the war. And where he lived when those decisions happened was at the Soldiers' Home, not at the White House.
And he came in contact with soldiers. In fact, there's one anecdote that apparently you hear about on the tour of the cottage of a Union soldier who literally walks right up to Lincoln while he's sitting in his rocking chair.
Right. It's a fascinating story about a soldier, an officer, whose wife had come down to help him recover from wounds, and then she was killed in an accident. And then he wanted to recover her body, went to the Soldiers' Home to talk to the president about it directly. And Lincoln was, you know, overwrought and tired at the end of the day, and he told him to, you know, go to the War Department. He said, "Am I to have no rest?" And then the next day he recovers from his sort of frustration, and he helps the soldier recover the body of his wife.
And he apologizes for, you know, and says, "Don't ever tell your child," to the soldier, "that a president talked to you that way and sent you away." But to us, even more revealing was that in 1862, a soldier could walk right up to him.
Not just a soldier, but anyone. The presidency then was much different, and the idea of cordoning off the White House or the Soldiers' Home was kind of unheard of.
If this home, as you say, was so important to understanding Lincoln, why don't we know more about it? Apparently, the recreation in the museum is very stark because nobody had photographs. Nobody knew where things were, what it looked like. Why?
Well, this is a place that was well known to Americans in the 19th century. And then over the years, it's just fallen out of people's public awareness. And so it's one of those miracles of preservation. The National Trust for Historic Preservation has just done a national service by preserving the place and restoring it and introducing it to another generation of Americans.
The fact that he could see the soldiers from this home, and they were being buried in a cemetery right across the street, and also the fact that he came across runaway slaves who'd formed encampments, how much did that, you know, impact his thinking about the Civil War, that going out to this summer place put evidence of it right in front of him?
Well, one reason why Lincoln removed the family to the Soldiers' Home was to get out of the White House. So for Lincoln, you know, reaching out and finding out for himself what was happening was a sort of essential component of his leadership.
Yeah. Well, we understand that President Lincoln last visited this cottage, his retreat, on April 13th, 1865. He and Mary had plans to see a comedy at Ford's Theater the very next night. The war was over. And, of course, we know what happened that very next night. So this was one of the last places he was.
Not only was the Soldiers' Home one of the last places that Lincoln probably visited, but it's also one of the first places he visited. Just a couple of days after his inauguration, he went out to the Soldiers' Home to look it over, probably on the recommendation of James Buchanan, who told him how wonderful the place was. So the Soldiers' Home actually frames Lincoln's presidency from beginning to end, and it's a vital part of his story.
And now we can all see it. The new museum in Washington opens to the public today. Matt Pinsker is professor of history at Dickinson College. He's been speaking to us about President Lincoln's cottage at the Soldiers' Home. His book about that cottage is called Lincoln's Sanctuary. And by the way, you can see photos of the new museum by going to our website, here-now.org. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And still to come today, singer-songwriter Lori McKenna. She was living paycheck to paycheck. Now her five kids call superstar Faith Hill Annie Faith. We'll hear from Lori in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Before you met me, I was a fairy, a princess.
That's Stoughton, Massachusetts singer-songwriter Lori McKenna singing her song Fireflies. Lori was juggling a music career and her life as the mother of five and wife of a plumber when a friend got her songs to country superstar Faith Hill. Hill had just finished recording her album, but she added three of Lori's songs to what became the 2005 double platinum CD Fireflies. Here's Faith's version of the Lori McKenna song.
I found mayonnaise bottles and poked holes on top to capture Tinkerbell. They were just fireflies to the untrained eye, but I could always tell.
Well, soon Lori McKenna was even busier. She performed Fireflies with Faith Hill on the Oprah Winfrey Show, toured with Faith and her husband Tim McGraw, and last year released her album, Unglamorous.
No frills, no fuss, perfectly us.
Lori McKenna is now back on tour on her own and as the opening act for singer Trisha Yearwood. And somehow she found time to join us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
In fact, we have to say we postponed your visit because you couldn't come in last time because?
Because I didn't have a babysitter.
We're thinking, Lori McKenna really's hit it big. You must have like an entourage of au pairs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
We've hired a babysitter for the first time last summer because we were going out with Tim and Faith and I needed to bring someone to help me. So
it's just amazing how your life has changed, but also not. Unglamorous, the name of the CD, some of the lyrics we know. You know, I love the ring in our bathtub has no diamonds or something like that. Was that your life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny. I just see myself as being really, really lucky that I have all these things that keep each other in line. Because people do ask me, well, how does life not change when your career has changed so much over the past couple of years? And really, five children, you know, they if they don't want it to change, it's not going to. And I kid around and I say this all the time, but, you know, they really just want to know what's for dinner.
Do you mind my asking? You look so young. How old are they? How old are you?
I'm 39. My oldest is 18. And then I have 15, 14, 6, and 3.
How do you guys do this? How do you make it work?
Well, I've been doing it for, you know, 10 years now. So it's been a gradual thing. I mean, when my husband and I got married, you know, I didn't look at him when I was 19 to say, I want to be a singer-songwriter someday. I'm going to be, like, taken off, you know, because it wasn't in my brain then.
Yeah.
And so we just sort of all figured it out. And we are figuring out as we go along, but he's great because he understands that this makes me happy and makes all the other things better for me. And, you know, he just makes it work, even though it's not the easiest thing for him, you know.
Well, you have your guitar here. In fact, one of the songs on Unglamorous, your latest CD, we've heard is about him. Could we hear just a little bit of I Know You?
Sure thing.
D.H. Lawrence would be your favorite poet if you thought poetry was cool. You have too much pride to be a thief and just enough gut to be a fool. Honey, I know you. Well, I know you. Well, I know that you feel bad for every bad thing that you do. You got a scar on your right cheek and the fear of
So that's about your husband, Gene. But does he really, for instance, have a comb in his pocket?
I say that song is about 90% highly accurate. I'm trying to get you to understand that if someone has a comb in their pocket, they sort of care about what other people think of them. And he's a bit like that. So he doesn't actually have that. And he doesn't have Southern Comfort either. But he... Those things I thought would sort of, you know, describe a person to you or put a person in your head.
Well, it's funny you mention the Southern Comfort, because I wanted to ask you about another song called Drinkin' Problem, someone who can't get out of bed because she's got a drinkin' problem. And you realize, you know, three quarters of the way through is that her problem
is that someone else is drinking. She, you know, this right. has become the anthem of enablers and codependents. It's the Al-Anon song.
Yeah. It's funny. It's, you know, the first time I heard the, you know, that's the Al-Anon song was from someone, you know, that waited after a show and said that to me. And
we should say Al-Anon is the 12-step group for families of alcoholics.
Right, yeah. right. And you know, it's one of those things where if you can write something that it may not be exactly about, like, the way I live, and the problem might not be exactly that problem, but if somebody else can sort of take their own life and put themselves into that character, then you've written something that you were supposed to write.
Well, I've been thinking while you've been drinking. Yeah, I know thinking is the last thing on your mind. But I've been hoping to get this out in the open. And hoping we ain't running out of time.
One song that is autobiographical is Leaving This Life. It's about your mom, who died when you were six from a blood disorder. Co-writer Mark D. Sanders pushed you to write it?
Yeah, that song was a song about perspective, as far as, like, when I was a little kid and I didn't have children, I felt so bad for myself because I had lost my mom. And then when I had my kids, instantly I just felt so bad for my mom, who didn't get to spend that time with her children. And it's funny because that's, I never would have went there with that song. I never would have said, because it's so hard to sing. It's so hard. If I think about it too much, I can't get through it. And I never would have really had the guts to go there. And he, you know, sort of pushed me into it. And in the end, it's like, I always say it's an example of a perfect co-write, because you have one person pushing the other person to be brave.
Say one thing. I've, you know, been a fan, listened to your music for a long time. Often tells of, you know, Hard Knocks, you know, a little more hardscrabble life. You are so much softer than your music.
Yeah, it's funny. I always say at shows, if people don't know me, they probably think I you know, I have it really bad. But I'm really a very happy person. I'm always like the person in the back of the cab wondering what the cab driver's life is like, you know. And we were sitting in the airport in Orlando the other day, and I'm watching this family sort of interact with their kids. And I'm trying to figure out, like, the way the mom works and the way the dad works. And you think, you know, that they've probably gone through, you know, certain things like everybody has. I love those stories about just regular people that have, you know, overcome or lived through amazing things, because really everybody has.
Well, interestingly enough, we wanted to end the segment with the song that Entertainment Weekly says is the song to download. It's called Witness to Your Life. So we'll go out on that from singer-songwriter Laurie McKenna. Her latest CD is Unglamorous. Laurie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Someone was crying and the bells rang. Then I don't remember a thing. You were talking, but the words came from somebody else. Someone said, kiss her.